I'm sitting with Professor Aziz Chaudhry, author of multiple books, professor at McGill University in the education faculty. And recently you co-published a book, Learning from the Ground Up, with Deep Kapoor. And I'm wondering, as a way to start, if you could just talk about the concept for the book, Learning from the Ground Up. What was your major goal in highlighting education in relation to grassroots social movements? Why was this an important topic to highlight through this publication?
Okay, sure. Thanks, Stefan. So the book's called Learning from the Ground Up, Global Perspectives on Social Movements and Knowledge Production. And it very much comes out of the interest that both myself and Deep Kapoor, who's at University of Alberta, have in relation to knowledge production and learning in the context of social movements and social action. So both of us are both academics, but are also involved in different kinds of social struggles, Deep particularly in relation to Dalit Adivasi politics in Orissa in India, and myself coming out of a number of sort of anti-colonial if you like, anti-capitalist movements in the Asia Pacific and so on. And I guess one of the things in terms of a sort of an academic viewpoint is that a lot has been written about social movements. There's a lot of social movement theory books in a number of different disciplines. And yet what often seems to be missing is a focus on thinking about how, rather than sort of social movement, the idea that social movements or people get together and act and then, you know, academics study them, that actually in the process of that action, in the process of engagement with social political injustices, whether it's at a local community level here in Montreal or national or regional or international levels, people also theorize, people also produce knowledge, and people learn. And one of the tricky bits about sort of thinking about this stuff, and we draw on some of Griff Foley's work in a really excellent book that Foley wrote in 1999 called Learning in Social Action, is that a lot of that learning is often kind of invisible, informal, incidental. Sometimes, you know, if you want to give an example, you know, it's sort of the stuff that happens when people go out putting up posters or in demonstrations, where people might not think of these things as necessarily being quote-unquote sort of learning or moments of education, but often it's through that process of sort of informal learning in some sort of collective organizing context that some really important kinds of analysis and ideas get born. And Robin Kelly, who's a really good scholar in the States, who wrote a book called Freedom Dreams, looking particularly at histories of black struggles for liberation in the US, you know, he says that perhaps the problem with sometimes looking at social movements is that scholars and some activists tend to sort of think about social movements kind of in terms of classifying whether they have quote-unquote succeeded or not, rather than actually looking at the ideas and the visions for a more just society or a more just world that actually come out of those struggles. So the book, which contains 14 chapters and it's edited by myself and Deep Kapoor, really tries to bring together mainly sort of contemporary, a couple of sort of more historical pieces in there, some different perspectives written by academics and trade unionists, activists, and some people who fit in all three categories of that altogether, looking at different sorts of struggles from the perspective of trying to sort of dig out and analyse that relationship between action, knowledge production, and learning.
And in the book, you really focus in on the details of activist experiences, which one could often perceive as being very removed from an academic context, from the process of, you know, writing a master's thesis, from the process of studying, writing essays. I guess before we get into some of the actual specific chapters in the book, which there's a lot of really amazing chapters, I was just wondering further if you could talk about your experiences as a social activist and then moving towards the academic sphere, kind of how your own experiences and thought processes led you to kind of explore this kind of theme of recognizing education and social movements? How does it relate to your own experience?
Okay, sure. Well, I mean, I think one of the things to recognize is that, you know, there's a politics of knowledge wherever we are. I mean, whether we're talking about how it is that certain, in academic disciplines, how certain people end up being sort of constructed as being the canon that you always have to refer to, you know, in social sciences, which is the area which I'm most familiar with, and how it is that certain voices, certain people, and if you like, the kind of the kinds of ideas do or don't appear in the stuff that we read in a lot of books around, you know, let's say in relation to social movements and so on. And I mean, I think there's a parallel there too in the context of looking at how it is that within social movements and in networks of non-governmental organisations, what, you know, some people call civil society, how there's a sort of a politics there about some positions and some people getting, you know, to be, if you like, a sort of a quote-unquote movement intellectual, and others not. In some ways, sometimes there's some parallels about looking at the way in which increasingly professionalised elites, whether they're academics or they're professionalised NGO people, might end up sort of dominating the sort of political space of things like, let's say, alternative fora or social forums, those kinds of things, and thinking through why it is that that takes place. But going back to your opening sort of remark, I guess the other question in terms of that sort of, you know, this sort of academia versus movements thing is, I think we have to be a bit careful about, you know, creating a sort of a rather simplistic sort of dichotomy or a binary between, you know, the university, you know, here we are up on the hill kind of having clever sort of scholarly ideas and thinking things through, and the rest of the world, because I think it depends very much on your sort of theoretical foundations or about what you think consciousness is, how you think consciousness is formed. For me, consciousness is something that happens in, it comes out of our engagement with other people, with nature, with, you know, the material objective conditions of the world that we're in. It doesn't just sort of float around here like a cloud, or, I mean, unfortunately, perhaps doesn't sort of come in those sort of flashes of, you know, divine revelation, at least not, you know, not for me in general. And it doesn't sort of float around like a sort of a cloud full of this thing called, in my view, of sort of discourse and narrative that is somehow detached from that material world. And so in that sense, and this comes through in, you know, my teaching and my academic work too, is that rather than sort of viewing engagement and having one's hands, you know, dirty, if you like, when you're doing academic work, as being problematic and somehow leading towards bad scholarship, because, you know, there's obviously there's a sort of been a dominant view around, or certainly has been challenged over many years around this idea that you can be detached and you should, you know, the best kinds of ideas come from this sort of detachment. We're never detached. We're never, you know, in terms of notions of objectivity, I mean, most people, you know, would have I think, come across some questions about when people put forward this idea that they're objective and they're neutral. You know, is that really so? How can one be like that? And I mean, for me, there's a question about, you know, okay, is it actually a good thing to be detached and neutral? Isn't it actually better, perhaps, to locate yourself in terms of the research that you're doing or the education that you're doing, and to be open about that, and then to move from there? And that doesn't mean that one's not open to other ideas or challenging or healthy debates. Not at all. But I think, you know, that's one of the things that's really important to think through in terms of, you know, what kinds of knowledge belong where and what kinds of knowledge count. And I think academic scholarship itself owes, whether or not it's always acknowledged, great deals of intellectual debts to the intellectual work that's taken place in social movements, whether it's, you know, women's struggles over the years, whether it's anti-colonial struggles. Very interesting piece by Susan Bucks Morse about how Hegel might not have come up with the master-slave concept that was so intrinsic, so important for a whole lot of, you know, sort of European social science scholarship, if there hadn't been a revolution in Haiti, and that, you know, talks about the importance of that actual kind of on the ground concrete struggle in, if you like, inspiring Hegel, making Hegel think through that idea. And I think we can see in lesser or greater ways, in different kinds of ways, the way that still that sort of stuff is playing out. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's been written around the quote-unquote anti-globalisation movement, which, you know, have been very active in. And it's interesting, you know, to see still how... There are sort of marks that are left on all kinds of places in academic scholarship by those kinds of struggles. Whether or not, again, the peoples and the struggles are acknowledged, and there's always a sort of a bit of a tension there between often different kinds of ideas and arguments and debates that have taken place in a much more collective setting, and then the pressure on individual academics, whether it's students or professors, to sort of, you know, come up with sort of single authored publications, and that's always a tension that's there. But I think these are important things to kind of just wrestle with and trying to think through, you know, at an intellectual level, at a kind of a practical level. Okay, so how do you do that? And so everywhere I think that we are, whether we're in the university or whether we're in social struggles, whether in NGO people summits or organising meetings, there are struggles over knowledge and over knowledge that's linked to power. And I think one of the things that's really useful to do as a sort of in an academic setting is to be able to usefully make visible kind of what's going on there, whether it's about analysing, let's say NGO documents or position papers or things like that, or whether it's about sort of thinking through dynamics in a meeting or thinking a bit about the political economy of NGOs. I mean, you know, who funds some of the organisations, what that means, without necessarily having a crudely deterministic view about it. I mean, because there's always all these places are sites of struggle. I think NGOs, trade unions, you know, community organising. But that is something, you know, one of the reasons with the book was really to sort of make explicit and to really document the fact that, and a lot of the struggles that are in the book are ones that aren't necessarily the ones that people will have read lots about over and over again, and are approached from a lens of trying to dig out and talk about the relationship between knowledge and learning and action in these struggles.
In a sense, the book Learning from the Ground Up that you co-edited with Deep Kapoor, on a very human level, it seems to be a celebration of the emergence of social theory and ideas as having their essential nature or their starting point as being rooted in community or activist experiences, that ideas aren't coming from imaginary places in ivory towers, but they're basically rooted in people's lives. And some of the most revolutionary and groundbreaking ideas are fundamentally linked to social justice movements. Why do you see there as being such a disconnect between the kind of social value given to grassroots struggles, you know, in terms of mainstream institutions like academic institutions or mainstream media? Little social value is placed on those experiences, you know, as opposed to, you know, the academic sphere, which is highly regarded. Of course, we're talking in a simplistic fashion. There's nuances, but why that dichotomy?
Well, I think there's a number of things going on there, and I think it also depends a lot on context, because there are certainly, traditions of very engaged, academic, whatever you want to call them, academic activists or scholars who are also kind of on the front lines of struggles. I mean, some of the struggles in Latin America, for example, in the Middle East, in different places where there are certainly, and here too, there are people who, if you like, put their bodies on their line and do what they can as people who often have a level of privilege but are committed to, social change and so on. I think there's all kinds of reasons around, what you just asked. I mean, if we look back at the sort of last 20, 30 years, the political context, whether we're talking about here in Canada or Aotearoa or New Zealand, where I used to be, or internationally, globally, in the global south, We look at sort of the rise, if you like, of free market economics and neoliberalism and the implementation of, very market competition, sort of market-driven policies, which have often ended up meaning states cutting back on areas like education, health, a whole lot of social services, and then kind of the subcontracting out of those services to non-profit organisations, whether it's, you know, community organisations here in Montreal, whether it's NGOs in the Global South and so on. And a particular kind of, if you like, social action that's a very sort of project-by-project driven way of doing, if you like, social change. And obviously, you know, social movements kind of come and go and have moments where they're very, you know, and again, very context-specific, may well be sort of very much on the ground, very much political forces. But, you know, there's a critique about... I don't want to sort of make this a very simplistic sort of critique of non-governmental organisations. There's a critique about the way in which over the last 20, 30 years, as part of that, there's been a kind of a disciplining of dissent that's taken place through what some people call the NGOisation of social change. So where, you know, NGOs, which are often funded by states, by sometimes the private sector, end up taking and changing sort of political space, and where often people in particularly, you know, in a number of different contexts, essentially move away from an idea that you need to mobilise, you need to stay on the streets, you need to do a variety of different things, and yes, sometimes perhaps need to form organisations and institutions that are somewhat more formalised, but not to sort of see that the end point of kind of social change is necessarily, you know, getting charitable status, getting, you know, an office with paid staff and all that kind of thing, and thinking that somehow that is the way forward for being able to change society. And so I think if we look then at sort of what that means in terms of knowledge and learning and so on, those kinds of spaces that become more sort of professionalized and more, if you like, in that kind of project-by-project mentality, dependent on external funding, perhaps less dependent on or less connected to a grassroots base, which may well have been there at some point or maybe not, we can sort of see that there are certain kinds of games and certain kinds of positions that, you know, often end up being played and taken. And so, you know, Henry Veltmeyer and Jim Petras wrote a book some years ago called Globalization Unmasked: Imperialism in the 21st Century, where they have a chapter called NGOs in the Service of Imperialism. And they talk about NGOs as being intellectual policemen, which kind of, you know, in these contexts of international coalitions about different issues or, if you like, sort of alternative people's forums or so on, essentially kind of act as gatekeepers and pick and choose which voices end up, getting prominence in these sort of civil society contexts, which ones get, you know, media coverage, which ideas and concepts end up being sort of put centre stage. They're very much in their book, their analysis is very much around a sort of an analysis of people that take a very strong, if you like, a sort of a class position, a Marxist sort of class analysis and so on, getting sort of filtered out. In my own work, what I've looked at and in my own experience, what I've seen happening too is actually the way in which that kind of process of disciplining dissent in NGO forums actually often filters out anti-colonial critiques. So, for example, in countries like Canada, Aotearoa New Zealand, you know, where we'll be talking about, you know, transnational corporations, and I write about this in a chapter that comes out of my sort of experience mobilising against the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, which was a free trade and investment grouping of 21 countries in the Asia-Pacific back in the 90s, where on a number of occasions attempts to put forward this critique, whether it was from the floor in the Vancouver People's Summit in 1997, held at the time that Jean Chrétien was hosting Bill Clinton and so on in Vancouver, Suharto Zhang Zemin, et cetera, et cetera. That there was a lot of focus on, let's say, transnational corporations, if they're in Burma, if it was related to China, if it was related to Indonesia. But I raised, for example, in a workshop on transnational corporations, the fact that there were transnational corporations, oil and gas corporations, forestry corporations that were going into unceded Lubicon-Cree territory in northern Alberta, which was sort of just just next door to BC. And the kind of reaction was kind of, oh, that's really interesting. Anyway, let's get back to to what we were talking about before. And that is a sort of an example, I guess, of some of the tensions that other, you know, chapters in this book also talk about. I mean, Robin Rodriguez from Rutgers University is also very active in Philippine solidarity work, migrant justice work, talks about a similar kind of dynamic when she was attending various civil society processes and meetings at the time of the Global Forum on Migration and Development held in Manila in late 2008, where, again, you know, she questions in her chapter the notion of expertise as put forward by, quote-unquote sort of civil society organisations, where she argued that the voices of grassroots and the analyses that come out of grassroots migrant struggles were kind of pushed to one side or overwritten in one of the so-called alternative summits that took place there, which was kind of mandated, if you like, by the official intergovernmental forum. Whereas in another forum that she was part of, in a more, if you like, grassroots, a more militant forum, you know, there was a very different kind of analysis that was being put forward, and people were articulating issues and people were acting on issues in a very different way. And so she also raises these sorts of questions around professionalisation within NGOs, the kinds of knowledge, the kinds of ideas, the kinds of positions that end up getting taken, at the expense very often and without necessarily accountability back to the very people that these organisations are supposed to be representing.
We're talking with activist and professor Aziz Chaudhry from the McGill Faculty of Education, co-editor of the recently published title Learning from the Ground Up. I just wanted to touch on one theme that is highlighted in a few chapters, which is grassroots education within labor struggles. Mm-hmm. There is an excellent chapter about the strike in Colombia, mm-hmm, against the privatization of social public works. Also, there's a great chapter on education within the process of organizing against neoliberal institutions like the G8, led by the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, CUPW, which are currently on strike here in Canada. So I'm just wondering if you could highlight, maybe given the strike right now of the postal workers here in Canada, the labor elements within Learning from the Ground Up, the book that you co-edited.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the chapter by David Blakeney, who's the National Representative of Education for English Canada for CUPW, and Mike Morrill, who's been involved with a number of unions in the States like SEIU, I think is a really rich and interesting one. And I mean, David's experience as a labour educator, as a rank and file, unionist, postal worker and so on, I think is a very rich one. He's somebody I've had come into my my graduate classes and talk with and basically work with, if you like, at a sort of a popular labour education basis with graduate students. And they're very often really blown away by the way in which he breaks down what I guess are often sort of put forward as being complex, you know, economic issues and questions around income inequality in Canada, etc., in a very kind of tangible, you know, way. I mean, I think there's an enormous wealth of history conceptual challenges and conceptual resources, rather, I should say, coming out of unions, coming out of labour education, coming out of struggles of migrant workers too. I mean, you know, there's another book that I co-authored with Eric Schrag and Jill Hanley and Steve Jordan and Martha Stegman called Fight Back, Workplace Justice for Immigrants, which we also talk about within that, sort of the tensions between learning to adapt and learning to resist from among, you know, migrant workers here in Quebec. Going back to the chapter in Learning from the Ground Up, I think what I like about that chapter too is that, and I think this is a theme that runs through the book, is that, you know, there's not a romanticized view of unions or of non-governmental organizations or of people's struggles as being sort of like, you know, valiant and perfect and you know, without blemishes. And they write quite clearly about, you know, some of the tensions about sort of being able to push forward education and action and positions and sort of members taking responsibility for their own learning, but facilitated by, you know, by popular educators, etc., within the union in a very kind of Freirean sort of way, which runs counter to, you know, some of the strands of unionism, business unionism, etc., that some people might be familiar about, which have sort of often dominated, you know, North American unions. And I think, you know, working in an education faculty, and I think very strongly that, you know, if we think about education, we need to have a broad conception of education and learning. We need to see that it's not something that just happens in formal settings like universities and schools. You know, it happens in non-formal contexts, like, let's say, the kinds of workshops that CUPW and other unions run on a whole range of different issues and contexts. And it's also that, going back again to that sort of informal, incidental learning that takes place as we act. You know, we kind of often, you know, often there's sort of a mix of the three, if you like. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important that when we think about those kinds of things, and when we think about social struggles, that we do think about the kind of the intellectual work that they put forward, and the visions and the ideas and the challenges that have come out of those struggles. And I mean, you know, just to, you know, end with CUPW. I mean, a lot of people now, for example, take for granted things like paid maternity leave, right? But I mean, there was a struggle. There was an actual material struggle that came, you know, quite high cost that CUPW was very much in Canada at the forefront out of, and that struggle made major material gains for a lot of people across Canada. But, you know, learning from also how and what the kind of the strategies and the learning and the framing and all that sort of stuff that took place in those struggles, in those historical struggles, I think is something that we need to kind of keep bringing back forward. And this book is one sort of small contribution towards trying to document different ways in different contexts around the world, whether it's Pakistan, Canada, you know, First Nations communities in Nova Scotia, you know, the different kinds of movements that have been taking place around anti-globalization stuff in different places. There's a lot of really rich ideas here, and they can be interesting intellectually as we study them, whatever, in universities, but they can also be really important if we actually want to do something about the injustices that we see in the world.
Professor activist Aziz Chaudhry, thank you so much for joining All Things McGill.
You're welcome, Stefan.